Ready?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Committee is reconvened. Where we left off, Senator Limmer was going to ask a question, and once we have a quorum here, we'll take up the A18 amendment for further consideration. Senator Limmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Lurie, on the A18 amendment in the first paragraph, lines 3 through 7, it makes reference to an appeal process. And I'm not on the Health and Human Services Committee, but could you just give me a little context? What would a person appeal to this board?
Well, the eligibility determinations for an individual is probably the largest item that would create the volume. And it's similar to what happens in the Department of Human Services today for processing of Medicaid eligibility determinations, and you need a process by which individuals can step forward and carriers and the like, again, carriers down on contested case hearings. But eligibility determinations is probably going to be the lion's share of the appeals that come forward.
And then in the process,
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the process of this appeal, is this meeting, would that be, since dealing with health, perhaps health records or identifiers of a particular citizen's medical information, would that be considered, would it be a private, non-public meeting, the appellate process?
Senator Lurie?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, absolutely. I mean, to the extent it was at the board, it would certainly be a closed meeting. The appeal itself probably wouldn't be conducted by the board itself, but whatever process is there for appeals would be a closed meeting, yes, especially if it pertains to not public data, not public data being, the umbrella that describes private, which is regarding individual, including the confidential, and includes non-public for entities and the protected non-public, which is the subset that's protected there. Not public covers all of that. It's a very broad definition, and the hearings and any meetings conducted by the board regarding not public, closed. We're not going to air any of this out with press or other folks able to be engaged in the process.
Mr. Chair,
Senator
Lurie, in that event, are the members referenced in law that they cannot share data to any other member of society but regarding the events that go on in this meeting?
Yeah, I mean, Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I believe it's in Chapter 13 is where those are found, and there's all of those still apply. And anyone who has access to this information is not able to share it, and there's incredibly stringent requirements for safeguarding the data and significant penalties for any disclosure that is not authorized. Under state law, even it requires notice if there has been a breach of any of these security measures, and in affecting any breach affecting more than 1,000 individuals, the agency has to also coordinate with the consumer reporting agencies. So, I mean, even if it's, there's disclosure if a mistake is made too, requirement. So, I mean, they're going to be closed. It's all subject to our really carefully crafted Chapter 13. It's entirely applicable for any of these individuals. And as far as the appeals process itself, I mean, I don't think anybody's envisioning any scenario where the board itself would be conducting these appeals. So, I mean, I'm not saying the board would never be in a situation where they'd ever see individual non-public data, but it wouldn't be in the context of an appeal, I don't believe. And whatever context it is, that's all governed by Chapter 13, and we're not affecting that. We're going to continue to respect the good work done largely here in this Senate Committee on Judiciary historically,
Chair,
to craft those protections.
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, elsewhere on this amendment, if you go to lines 11 through 16, when there's a issue of an agreement regarding a health carrier, health insurer. That's being conducted by an administrative law judge. Why are we not applying the same system of an administrative law judge to the appeal process?
Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, largely, you know, the contested case proceeding is a very, very robust, in-depth, and expensive procedure. And the experience, like over at DHS, with eligibility determinations is that it's a good but really lean, much less expensive appeals process that really dispenses with the lion's share of the disputes. I don't remember the exact dollar amount, but it really at a good way that respects individuals' rights to appeal and often just informs them of the process that was undertaken, gives them the rights to contest whatever data was used, and does so just much more economically. For a big decision regarding a health carrier, whether they're, you know, able to participate in this exchange, that's a very different beast. And trying to move that into the more full-blown, much more expensive, cumbersome, time-consuming process does make sense at that point. We want to make sure everybody has the right ability for redress when they believe they've been grieved. And I think that strikes a good balance between what we've done in the past. I mean, again, the appeals process, I think, will look something quite similar to what we have today in DHS regarding eligibility determinations.
Mr. Senator Lori, do you know the average cost of taking a contested case through OAH versus doing it internally at DHS now?
I'm sure that information is in the room here.
Mr. Turpin?
We have been working, Mr. Chair, Senators, we've been working with the Office of Administrative Hearings. We've been able to give them some estimates. We have not gotten the final detail back on a per hearing cost breakdown, but that's what we're seeking. Part of the additional detail that's being provided to them is the detail provided in the recent federal guidance on the procedural requirements behind the eligibility appeals. So that additional information will allow the Office of Administrative Hearings to flesh out what their precise costs would be. This bill does allow for an administrative law judge at the Office of Administrative Hearings to carry out such an eligibility determination, or it could be an impartial person within the exchange itself, or it could be another state agency, again, under the terms of an interagency agreement to carry out this function. So as long as those procedural requirements are met, it provides flexibility to identify the exact adjudication entity that would be carrying out those functions.
Mr. Turpin, do you know what the costs were at DHS approximately? Anything you can rely on? Do you know numbers well enough to be able to state them? Or?
Mr. Chair, Senators, I won't. My understanding is the DHS per hearing costs are in the $300 per hearing range, but I would defer to DHS on the precise numbers.
Okay. And in comparison, do you have any idea what DHS's costs for the cases that go through the contested case hearing process at OAH, approximately what those costs are? I'm not going to hold you to the exact dollar amount, but just for comparison purposes, we have.
Mr. Chair, Senators, the numbers that are coming immediately to mind are related to some of the licensing hearings related to DHS contested cases, and I do think some of those are in the $10,000 range. They're certainly a much higher dollar amount because, again, these are usually cases where both parties are represented by counsel. The evidentiary rules are stricter. There is much more formal process to those than what would go into an eligibility hearing, where an individual most of the time is not represented by counsel, neither the agency nor the individual. These are usually much more informal opportunities for individuals to present evidence and identify their dispute with the determination that was arrived at.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if this is a question that's within our jurisdiction or not, but who makes up the appellate board? Are these who are they, and how are they selected?
Who makes up? Senator Lurie.
Mr. Chair, who makes up what now?
Senator Lurie, who makes up the composition of the board, the appellate board, and who appoints them? I'm assuming there's an appointment process. How does one become an appellate board member?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, the appellate board, I mean, the board that runs the exchange marketplace is delineated in this bill. And that's not the same thing as the board that would be hearing appeals. So I'm having trouble really ferreting out your question. The appeals process, we're complying with federal rules and saying that the board needs to establish a process for appeals for individuals and employer eligibility determinations. And we're not going much beyond that. They need to make sure that that appeals process provides for reasonable opportunity for these individuals and that it operates in a timely manner. The examples that we've cited are how eligibility appeals run in the Department of Human Services. I don't think we're looking at something terribly different from that, but the Department of Human Services has a separate wing that's distinct and independent from the eligibility determination unit. And so a model like that could work. And in fact, in the bill, it allows for agreements like the board could actually just use the DHS appeal process and contract with them to run these eligibility determinations through that existing model, which actually might make some sense. But the core requirement that we need to have in here is that the board will establish adequate appeals procedures that begin with what happens at the board, but never stay within the board. There would be additional appeal opportunities beyond the board level, no matter which route they took. And all of these would have to comply with other additional federal and state laws.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Limmer,
I guess it, as I'm beginning to peel this back a little bit, we're not making rules for a already created board. We're giving the authority of the Minnesota Insurance Marketplace, that's the board.
Yes.
And we're giving them the authority to create an appellate process.
But it's not a judicial process, it seems.
That's to determine the appeal of individual or employer eligibility questions.
Okay.
Now, we've often give authority to agencies and boards to do whatever we think the legislature in our wisdom has decided that they do, but I kind of think that we're a little bit more specific. We may say X number of members must come from this discipline. Another X number of members must work within the agency. Maybe there's a legislator that is supposed to be on something, some type of commission or some type of board. And in this case, I don't see that.
Yeah.
So we're basically just saying go create an appellate process and, give us a report on February 1st of next year. But
Mr.
I don't know if I'm comfortable with that without giving a little bit more direction to an advisory board, or not an advisory, I'm sorry, an appellate responsibility to a board secondhand regarding our citizens' eligibility requirements or not. It's a lot to ask for without having a little bit more confinement by the legislature. Do you have any comment regarding that? Why would we do that?
Senator Lurie.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, this is beginning to put some framework around what the appeals process needs to look like. The feds are in the process of issuing more guidance on what needs to be included in whatever appeals process is determined. And if we try to get a lot more specific today, we run the risk of having specificity that comes up against the federal guidance that is still forthcoming. And so we're talking here in terms of specific goals that need to be met with the appeals process. You know, some of this will be determined before we're done in 2014. This is as much as we know by the March deadline that we have to get out the door. I mean, much of it might even be available for us to consider later in the session in 2013 if we want to dig back into it. But, I mean, the core elements are you need an appeals process that gives folks an opportunity to be heard and notice regarding the hearings and make sure that their appeals are heard timely, and that's what this bill does.
Well, Mr. Chairman, one last question on this.
And then we'll go to Senator Hall.
So am I understand by your answer that the feds have not created the guidelines for the establishment of an appellate board as of now, and you're asking for us to not give any direction or framework to the board for creating the appellate process? We just want to give them the authority to figure it out pending some future decision by the federal government? That isn't it clear yet?
Senator Lurie.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I mean, I think I just described that. I mean, I would characterize it slightly differently. I think we're giving pretty clear direction about what we're expecting in terms of in terms of how this appeals process would function, but it's not it doesn't have every level of specificity that you're desiring as well.
Mr. Chair, I don't think there's a lot of specificity I'm asking for yet, but some of the things that we may want to consider is, are these individual citizens that are questioning their eligibility for their own medical insurance? When they go before a board, are they under oath? Are they not under oath? Do they have opportunity for legal counsel? If they can't afford one, will one be appointed for them? Under at least a trial, you would get that. Under the protection of perhaps an administrative law judge, you might have that as a requirement. But I don't see that under some board that's, or the directions for the board are vaguely written. And I don't think it would follow under more of a bureaucratic department agency code of governing rather than a judicial one. So, and I haven't heard anything from the federal government if they're thinking about that either. So that's why I'm raising, and I'm not getting specific. These are just basics to when the intersection of a private citizen's expectations for something with their government is expected and there's a dispute. Those are the things that are essential elements when that relationship becomes that way.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Lurie. I wonder, I'm looking at lines 9.35 and 10.1, 10.2. And on 10.1, I believe it is.
Senator Hall, I'm sorry. Looks like you're going back into the data portion.
Okay.
Right now we have the A18 amendment.
Okay,
before us
I'll
on
wait.
The appeals.
Thanks.
So we'll come back to that section in a moment. Are there any other questions relating to the A18 amendment? I do have one amendment to the amendment in light of my comments earlier about reporting. So I propose to amend on line 1.22 after 2014, comma, insert and February 1, comma, 2015, comma. Well, that's my motion to amend. Can I make a motion to amend as chair?
Mr. Chair, as your advisor, you cannot make an amendment or a motion. You
I'll ask Senator Sharon.
I accept the friendly amendment.
I'm
glad you asked, though.
We'll get this done right here soon enough. All right, so Senator Sharon incorporates that change to her motion for the A18 amendment. Is there any other questions or comments on the A18 amendment?
Could you just repeat it?
The addition
the addition.
Amendment?
Yeah. What
on line 1.22 after 2014, comma, insert and February 1, 2015, comma. So there will be two reports to the legislature then. Not seeing any further questions or comments, all in favor of adopting the A18 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The A18 amendment is adopted. Shall we now turn to the A19 amendment? Senator Sharon moves adoption of the A19 amendment. Senator Hall, your question would go I think to, let's see here.
That,
well, this is
that wouldn't pertain to 19 either,
it's,
I don't think.
It's a combination. It's
okay.
A cross-reference. It's kind of a combination of
okay.
data.
Well, this amendment is kind of a combination of data and open meeting related stuff, so why don't you go ahead, Senator Hall.
Okay. Back to line 9.35 and 10.1 and 2. If you could explain, Senator Lurie, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Lurie, if you could explain what is summary data.
Senator Lurie or Mr. Turpin.
Summary data might be data like trying to measure the quality of a health provider or something like that. It would be summarized. It would be a roll-up. It would be de-identified. There's nothing in it that could identify an individual or an entity, and you're rolling it up to a higher level to try to be able to look at broader trends in the marketplace. So that's what the concept of summary data.
Mr. Chair?
Senator
Hall. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Lurie, isn't there already a definition for that summary data in Chapter 13? And if so, why do we have it here, too? Is that redundant?
Mr. Chair,
Senator
Senate
Lurie.
Counsel gave me an excellent explanation for why this is repeated frequently within our bills. And maybe I would, rather than try to stumble through that myself, defer to Senate counsel and ask for the explanation of why we repeat the ability to do summary data in regards to what? It's in regards to non-public, right? Yeah.
Ms. Pontius?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Hall. I mean, it's sort of a weird historical quirk under the Data Practices Act that we have a summary data statute, but technically it only talks about private data on individuals. It doesn't talk about non-public data. And so as a result, sometimes when people see that, they think somehow it means that you can't create summary data from non-public data. I think you can. And really, you'll see this language in other places in the statute where it's just intended to clarify that you can create this data that does not identify either individuals or business entities or employers, whomever. It's just descriptive in nature. And so that's why that language is there. So, I don't think it's legally necessary, but it does make it clear. And because it's already been used in other places in the statute, kind of raises an inference perhaps that you need it there. But at some point in time, we've had this discussion, it might make sense to go back and revisit the whole summary data statute, but today is not the day to do that. So.
Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Chair, on that point, I know there's references to in the bill that refer to a title of information called not public, and I've also heard non-public. Sometimes they're exchanged for one another, and I was wondering if counsel, we've had a lot of new people on our committee, and it might be helpful for me to get a review of that, and certainly others. Could counsel give us a brief description of the differences?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lurie, not public is the umbrella term. So it refers to all the different kinds of data they have that are not accessible to the public. So it could be private data on individuals. It could be confidential data on individuals. Or on, for the data that are not on individuals, it would either be non-public or protected non-public. So you do get into these kind of grammatical tongue twisters sometimes.
It's all clear now.
Senator Lurie, could you step us briefly again through the A19 amendment and what you seek to do with it?
Yes. On lines, Mr. Chair, lines 1, 5, and 6 is an internal cross-reference, just to be clear where you'll find the open meeting provision as you read the bill for guideposts. Lines 1.7 to 1.9, it gets into the open meeting law piece, and one of the things that wasn't clear is it said meetings where not public data will be discussed, again, not public being the umbrella, so anything that's private or about entities. It says or portions of meetings where the not public data is covered. So that was kind of a technical so that you could go into a closed session during a meeting that's otherwise open to discuss these closed items. Let's see. Next, the rest of, a lot of this is fairly technical. Line 1.10, it just where it said are closed, it says must be closed. It's just a drafting change. Lines 27 and 28 are deleted. This is getting rid of that the line 5, the section paragraph 5, rather, within there. Lines 526 to 29, we're kind of just moving the data into one section where this is in the responsibilities and powers of the marketplace. And we had in here authorization to enter into agreements with state and federal when necessary, and then we spelled it out. And then later in Section 7 in the data, we talked about the authorization to actually share the data. So, I mean, there were two pieces, authorization to enter into agreements and authorization to actually share pursuant to those agreements. And just in terms of drafting, it seemed to make much more sense to take that responsibilities and powers of the marketplace, paragraph 5 there, and just say entering into information sharing agreements with federal and state and other entities is okay. If you want to see how that's done, you need to go look at the data provision in Section 7. So that's why we deleted lines 27 and 28 and referenced as authorized under 62V06. 115 is a technical naming convention. 116, sharing is one of the things that sharing and is one of the things they need to be able to do. Lines 117 is the clarification that I mentioned in my initial summary, saying that this is clarifying that it is the board that is making the determination regarding whether it's reasonable and necessary for the operations of the board. And then lines 118 through 120 are the piece from paragraph 5 that's being moved back into the data section, so that data sharing agreements must include adequate protections with respect to the confidentiality and integrity of the data to be shared, and they have to comply with all applicable law. So that's the structure. We're trying to clean it up a little bit, leave the guideposts so that people can read the statute, but combine all of the data into one section. So it's mostly technical. The only substantive change is that portions of the meeting could be changed. The rest of it is really drafting and readability. And, of course, it detracts from readability when around the table here while we're trying to engross it on the fly. But that is a description of what the A-19 amendment does.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Lurie. I'm going back, and again, if I'm off the amendment, let me know. Back to line 3234 on page 9, 3234, where I've heard this term reasonably necessary. I guess I've got two questions with that is, who decides what's reasonably necessary? And if it's not necessary, why are we doing it? Why are we adding the reasonably? And who makes that decision?
Mr. Chair, Senator Hall, that's what in the A-19, line 117 there on lines 31 and 34, it draws that out and makes it clear that the board makes the determination as to whether the sharing is reasonably necessary. That is something that would be subject to challenge, certainly. And the board would have to certainly be prepared to defend their determination regarding reasonable necessity.
Thank you, Mr. Senator Chair. Senator Lurie, so we're setting up the board to decide not if it's necessary, but if it's just reasonably necessary. I mean, maybe that's a legal term that I don't know, and maybe that's in a lot of legal things, reasonably. I just don't understand that one, but...
Do they want to clarify? Phrase, Senator Hall.
Catch-all broadens it a little bit.
To say.
Okay.
But it does leave it open to some interpretation. Right, but it gives some discretion and some flexibility to figure out the details.
Chair.
Senator Hall, did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, just real quick. Well, and that's kind of my point. If you've got a board that really is on their own and not really overseen, I'm not sure who oversees the board but themselves, and then they decide what's reasonably necessary, it makes it too broad for me, I guess. And maybe I'm just being nitpicky here.
Senator Limmer?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. On the amendment, the last, if I can find it, the last sentence.
Amend the title accordingly?
No, second to the last, I think. I don't have my
number of the
section.
Oh,
here it is. Line 20 of the amendment, where it talks about data to be shared and comply with applicable law. Are we talking of federal law or state law in this case? Or is it both?
Senator Lohr.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, it is my intent that it be both. I'd ask counsel to confirm that that is what would be embodied there. It's my intent to have it be both.
And, Mr. Chair,
if
there's a conflict between federal and state law, such as the more stringent privacy requirements under state law as opposed to the federal HIPAA laws, What takes precedent? And then who makes that decision?
Senator Lori?
You know, in this really detailed area, I'm going to turn it over to Mike Turpin.
Mr. Chair, Senator, with regards to the final exchange security and privacy rule does address some of the conflict issues and does make clear that, again, in laying out broad principles and standards for requiring privacy and security, that the more stringent data privacy requirements under state law would apply unless there's separate federal law that would supersede or preempt those. One of the elements within the exchange, the Affordable Care Act, is it assumes non-preemption unless the state action would utterly confound the effectuation of the exchange carrying out its required function. So in that sense, the state law would, if more strict, would hold as the standard for the privacy requirements.
And Mr. Chair, who makes that
Senator
decision?
Limmer.
Who makes that decision?
Some
of these decisions are rather gray and trying to define what's more stringent. Do the feds have a more stringent law, or does the state? And sometimes it's only by a simple interpretation rather than a black and white decision. Who would make that decision then?
Mr. Turpin?
Mr. Chair, Senators, these are things that other state agencies grapple with today, and I think we would go about resolving those in the same way, seeking guidance either from the federal government directly on issues governed either through the Office of Civil Rights for some of the federal data issues, or in conjunction with our state IPAD division within the office or the Department of Administration.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Limmer.
Again, we kind of keep talking in a circle, and we go back to this future reference to federal guidance, perhaps state guidance, things that haven't been created yet, and we're expected to make a decision of going in that direction, but somewhat into a vague cloud that we really are not getting a specificity on regarding what may be applicable and what may not be applicable in a case like this. I wish we had more of a black and white picture. We usually deal with that in this body, and I'm a little troubled that we don't have a bit more clear picture of how we're going to apply the law. And what are we going to acquiesce to, and acquiesce to a federal decision? Some of the decisions I've seen in the federal government, and it's not chastising any one administration over another. There's enough blame to go around. But you see the references of No Child Left Behind. You see no other references on labor law. You see other references all over. old civil rights law versus new civil rights law. And yet we're given the direction, at least on data privacy, that the states have a right and authority to write a more stringent law protecting the privacy of their citizens. And for some reason, now we're asked, in order to merge this healthcare system of the federal government approaching us, we now have to kind of lay down and trust that some regulation of the federal government, or perhaps some compilation of the state government, will give us the direction. And yet, I haven't read it, I haven't seen it, I don't know where it's going, and I'm a little concerned that we're making permissive authority in this decision, and we don't know where we're going.
Senator Lori.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, you know, prior to any actual implementation of data sharing arrangements of any type, you have to have this data sharing agreement on the front end, and that's where the entities involved go through this really in-depth conversation about what laws apply. And it's similar to what entities struggle with today to make sure that these data sharing agreements that will be public and scrutinized regarding exactly how these will function. And we're giving the board the authority to create those agreements and telling them that they have to comply with state law and federal law. And if they need to go through that exercise and find, you know, actual contradictions, I believe that the federal guidance is sufficient to indicate that Minnesota will be able to have our laws, where they're more strict, still be effective. And that's the instruction that I see we're giving this board here, is to first create these data sharing agreements where you apply with, you know, where you comply with all of our laws. You know, I mean, and I would share your concerns if they came back with a data sharing agreement that did not, because I really do think this is excellent work that we've done collectively here in the Senate Judiciary Committee in crafting carefully Chapter 13 and all of our various data protections.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Lori, I think Senator Limmer is very polite. I think this is half-baked. I think it leaves an awful lot of Minnesotans with a lot of really big questions about their future. And I think that is a terrible disservice to the people that you are trying to serve with this bill. And I understand about the federal mandates. I accept the fact that the law has been passed. It's constitutional. We have to do something. But my suggestion is you go back to the drawing board, work with the federal government, get some better answers for us. I think that's your role as chair, me personally. I think that's your role. And I think the governor should help you. We deserve better answers than what you're getting us today. And I will help you with that in any way that I can. Secondly, I have to say that I have absolutely no confidence, zero confidence, that the data sharing will actually be confidential, that it won't be breached. I'm wondering if anybody has read about Anne Marie Rasmussen and the hundreds of times that her private driver's license data was accessed inappropriately, and the hundreds of thousands of dollars that government agencies are now paying her for those data breaches. Or if anybody in this room read about the DNR data breaches, I got a letter. 5,000 Minnesotans had their data breached. And we've got an amendment that I think is totally irresponsible, saying that there will be adequate protections with respect to the confidentiality and integrity of the data to be shared and comply with applicable law. I don't believe it. I bet most Minnesotans don't believe it. And I think that the Department of Administration owes us an explanation about what is happening. And I don't think that we should just say, well, we'll get an iPad decision. We'll turn this over to the Department of Administration. They have been less than useful in helping Minnesotans with the data breaches, and that's why we are not convinced. I'm more than suspicious. I'm more than untrusting. I'm absolutely convinced that you cannot protect Minnesotans' data. And until you can, I think this is half-baked. I'm also very concerned about the rulemaking authority. I've heard it said both ways about this bill. Sometimes you say it isn't really rulemaking authority, and sometimes you say it is. And I'd really like to know. So, Mr. Chair, I'm wondering if we can ask counsel about the application of the language in this bill and whether or not the rules that would be made by this board would be enforceable in Minnesota.
Senator Ortman, the rulemaking provisions of the bill are not within the Judiciary Committee's jurisdiction. That was state and local government, so we were not going to go into that.
Well, Mr. Chair, are they not referenced in the amendments that were brought before this committee?
Only as they related to a data provision that was cross-referenced, well, not to the rulemaking provisions themselves.
Mr. Chair, I think it's a fair question to ask whether or not there would be enforcement or could be enforcement of this authority or these so-called rules that would come out of this body. And I think it's fair to ask counsel and the Judiciary Committee to answer the question about enforceability.
Well, we'll see if we have an answer for you, but we're not going to spend extended time on rulemaking questions here today. Counsel?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Ortman, I mean, the rules would be enforceable. I mean, are you speaking of data practices rules? Or?
Senator Ortman?
Any rulemaking authority that they might have is my question.
Well, the rules have the force and effect of law if they're adopted. So it just, you know, it could be enforced as any other law depending on the context. Like data practices ones, there's remedies under the Data Practices Act. You can ask for commissioner's opinions. You can bring a private action if you want. There's also an ALJ process now that you can use if you want if you're contesting something. So if they adopted a rule and then violated it, you might have a remedy under there and you'd have a private cause of action. I don't know if that helps part of your question.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment just makes me even more concerned about the breadth of this bill and how much power this organization is going to have.
As to the A-19 amendment, any further questions or comments? Not seeing any. Senator Sharon's motion is to adopt the A-19 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. A-19 amendment is adopted. Now, we do have a number of members of the public that have expressed an interest in testifying. We'll take them in the order that they requested to testify. And as I understand, the first person up is John Tyler, and next up will be Alexandra Mateja. I hope I pronounced that correctly. Mateja? Thank you. Please remember to sign in on the clipboard also so we have the committee record. And we're going to ask you to keep your comments confined to 3 or 4 minutes if you possibly can, and then we'll have questions if there are any as well. But Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Distinguished members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, my name is John Tyler, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify before this committee. I would like to stress that I am testifying on behalf of myself and also the Republican Healthcare Task Force exclusively, not with regard to any other organizations I may be part of. The Minnesota Marketplace Exchange Bill, I really can't think of any other committee more appropriate to make this testimony before. I currently serve as vice chair of the Republican Healthcare Task Force. I also own a financial planning agency as well. The Republican Healthcare Task Force is a multi-professional organization of individuals that are volunteers and volunteer their time from the medical industry, from the insurance industry, from the public, from the legislative community, or legislator community as well. I think one thing that perspective of this that I think might be helpful for this committee would be a historical perspective of this exchange issue and how it might provide some insights because it has ties to the exchange bill. That's
excuse me, Mr.
You.
Tyler, would you please pull the mic closer to you? So
you bet. Thank you.
Pick it up. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In the 1990s, as vice chair of the Republican Healthcare Task Force then as well, we were involved in a chief battle against the Clinton Health Security Act. That failed 1993 legislation sought to establish a National Health Information System or National Health Board. Section 5101 of that act stated the National Health Board shall collect, report, and regulate the collection and dissemination of the healthcare information. The Clinton Health Security Act may have required the board to oversee the establishment of an electronic data network, consisting of national and regional centers that collect, compile, and transmit information. The board was to establish a system to provide for a unique identifier number for each eligible individual, each employer, each health plan, and each health care provider. The health security card was to be issued to each individual. Without that card, no care. These were our chief reasons at that time for our opposition to the Clinton Care Act. It could not withstand the spotlight of public scrutiny, and I believe it was chiefly responsible for the Republican takeover of the U.S. House of Representatives in 1994. The Clinton Health Security Act failed, but in 1996, the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act mandated the creation of unique identifiers for individuals, employers, doctors, hospitals, and health insurers. So far, only the patient identifier has not been created, but it is in process. HIPAA eliminated all legal patient consent requirements for the sharing and use of private patient medical records.
Mr. Tyler, I'm not going to take this out of your time, but I just want to let you know that we do have your remarks in writing, have been distributed to the members of the committee, and they will become a part of the record.
Thank you, sir. In 2004, President George W. Bush issued an executive order to build a national health information network. This is to tie together health information exchanges between integrated delivery networks, pharmacies, government, doctors, hospitals, and a network of networks. In 2009, President Obama turned President Bush's executive order into federal law, the Economic Recovery Stimulus Act, which included a section called the Health Information Technology for Economic and Clinical Health Act. This act gives between $27 and $36.5 billion to build the National Coordinator for Health Information Technology. Its purpose is to tie together health information exchanges. It penalizes doctors that refuse to use computerized linkable patient records by January 1st of 2015. It has little to do with insurance purchasing and everything to do with exchanging patient insurance and healthcare information between government and the private sector. Thus, the name exchange, it is an exchange of information between government entities. The 2010 Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act established the Independent Payment Advisory Board. This board has the power to determine health care treatment for millions on government programs, and arguably upon full implementation of the PPACA, individuals that are privately insured having purchased their coverage through an exchange. None of the above is possible without the state-by-state implementation of federally accountable information exchanges. History is likely repeating itself in the bill before you. Please vote no to a Minnesota healthcare information exchange, because without it, Minnesotans will not be part of a national healthcare database and a national takeover healthcare information insurance and much more. State exchanges open the door to federal government controls, permitting laws and rulemaking and the national tracking of health insurance status, healthcare data sharing, national registration for IRS enforcement of the individual mandate, and individual personal medical decision making, nationalized health records paid for by the states, a centralized data hub. According to the accompanying USA Today article that you have before you, every state exchange is a federal exchange that will be used to control the entire healthcare industry from insurers to doctors nationally. To quote the enclosed USA Today article, by mid-December, the federal government is planning to quietly enact what could be the largest consolidation of personal data in the history of the republic. If you think identity theft is a problem now, wait until Uncle Sam serves up critical information on 300 million American citizens on a platter. Hyperbole? Unlikely. I would like to ask each of you, when you ran your campaigns, did you run your campaigns on enacting a national effort to collect and retain personal health records, tax information, dates of birth, addresses, social security numbers, and more into a single consolidated location on every Minnesotan? How many of you believe you could be reelected once the truth of all this becomes known that you supported this in this committee, right here and right now? Did you stand up for Minnesotans' privacy by voting no on this bill, or did you open the portal to federal intrusion into Minnesotans' private information by voting yes to Senate File 1? It is your legacy to leave and to defend. I invite you to read this article, The Potential Obamacare Privacy Nightmare, because I believe it is accurate, I think it is valid, and I think all the issues and questions that have been brought up here today point to the very fact that this is not just a state initiative, this is a state federal initiative of gathering data, and I think the fact that we have a Tennyson warning every step of the way through this bill should tip you off to the fact that there's a lot of private information that you are being asked people to give as a means of gaining a kind of federal subsidy of premiums. That is an inappropriate inducement to give up too much to receive a premium subsidy. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tyler, and let the members know also that the USA Today article that Mr. Tyler referenced has also been handed out to the members and will be a part of the record. Are there any questions for Mr. Tyler? Thank you. Seeing none, I will invite Alexandra Mattea to the table. Mr. Tyler, please remember to sign in before you go too far. All right, thank you. And up next will be Denny Nystrom as well. So, Ms. Mattea, please present your testimony. Try to confine it to 3 or 4 minutes as well, if you will. We've got a number of people that also want to testify today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Alexandra Mattea, and I am an ordinary citizen currently residing in Prior Lake. I've lived in this country most of my life, but I also lived under the communist regime. Thus, I know what it means to be free, and I know what it means to live in constant fear. This legislation proposed in Senate 501 terrifies me. As representatives of the people of the state of Minnesota, in all conscience, how can you rob the people of this state of their right to keep their private records private? You say it's voluntary, but what if the exchange is my only choice for insurance? What if a person needs it to make insurance affordable? Can you even imagine what power this legislation will give to our federal government? Can you imagine being afraid to speak freely for fear that someone will report you to a governmental authority? Can you imagine your life when the government's bureaucrats, with their far-reaching tentacles, will control every aspect of your life? I've been there before. I don't want to go back there. I know from experience that when the government knows all about you, the government wins and you lose. You are no longer free. You are no longer a citizen. You no longer matter. You no longer have rights. None. No rights. You become insignificant, disposable, nameless, just a number in their database. At least under communism, there were no elaborate databases tracking every aspect of my life. I am terrified of this exchange. I don't want to buy my insurance to the government. This exchange will not make us happier. It will not make us healthier, nor will it allow us access to more affordable health care. This exchange will enslave us and bring us another step closer to the Orwellian world where we will forever be under the Big Brother's watchful eye. And I am positively, absolutely sure that if the horrors of the socialized health insurance were truthfully and clearly presented to the American public, Obamacare would be overwhelmingly rejected and we would not be at this junction today. Please do not fall in line with the federal mandates, but keep in mind what is best for the people of Minnesota. Please reject this legislation and let freedom prevail. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Mattea. Senator Cohn.
Chairman, ma'am, I'm forced to ask. So you're comparing the Federal Affordable Health Care Act to Stalinist Russia?
I'm not comparing. I'm just saying that I know what it's to live under communism and being afraid. And when government knows a lot about you, they can do a lot to you. I treasure my freedom in this country. I don't want it eroded.
And Mr. Chairman, I would just state for the record that I have a number of constituents who immigrated from Russia as well, and who actually are very supportive of the Federal Affordable Health Care Act, who also lived in Russia during the time of communist domination.
I can't speak for Russia. I'm not from Russia. But
I tell you
that I am very concerned about the erosion of the freedoms in this country because I see what I left behind coming here, following me to this country. I love this country. I don't want it to deteriorate.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, I apologize if I inferred from your comments that you had migrated from Russia.
Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Mattea. Denny Nystrom, and after that will be Jill Thompson. Mr. Nystrom?
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Who do you have with you here today?
Pardon me?
Who is with you here today?
I've got my wife, Dana, with me.
Okay.
We stick close together, medical issues, and just look pretty tight together. So she's here to support and waive the fanfare.
We're voting today.
As a private citizen, I have purchased insurance products based upon need and data comparisons. We have lived in several states over the years and adjusted to the insurance variations from state to state while recognizing that coverage is designed to meet the unique need of the consumer. In 1994, Hillary Clinton attempted to stretch the role of government through cost containment using various HMO gatekeepers. Here we are again, only with the greater force to control the populace. As we see Obamacare unfold, it's becoming very clear that this is a massive intrusion on citizens' privacy through markets evolving via personal data. Purchasing insurance is my job. Helping others in need, not a problem. I can do that. Minnesota Care, Medicaid, miscellaneous other sources who are financially competent handle that task. Are we clear with the government definition of data? It's in pieces. Webster and Wikipedia defines data, paraphrased, as factual information used as a basis for reasoning. Who will be doing the reasoning? Is this where the private citizen will feel the consequences of their personal relationship with their medical provider fade away? Now data in Obamacare delivery becomes manipulated based upon cost containment, medical procedures dictated through data. I've seen it personally. May I say data equals cost containment, rationing, the final consequence of government control, government markets. Data and the citizens' relationship with their medical provider is now in conflict. Will data collected include the citizens' personal information like IRS, prescription usage,
safe at all,
firearm usage, firearm ownership, driving record, and that's just to name a few. As this legislation moves forward for consideration, I would ask that a great deal of soul searching is done to clearly understand what is data and why it has a place in state and federal government's hands. My firm belief, after 22 years' exposure to major medical procedures with my wife Dana, government data collection has only one purpose: state and federal government control of citizens. Stop and rethink this legislation now. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Nystrom. Any questions for Mr. Nystrom? All right, please remember to sign in on the clipboard there. We will now invite Jill Thompson to come to the table, and after Ms. Thompson will be Colleen Smith.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jill Thompson, and I'm a private citizen.
Welcome, Ms. Thompson.
Thank you. The more I hear about the facts and details of this bill, the more concerned I become. And so in regards to this committee, my concern is about data sharing and personal privacy. I would like to say that the amount of information that seems likely to be passed around from agency to agency and ultimately shared with the federal government, the passing and implementation of this bill makes me very uneasy. Despite attempts today to allay people's fears about this law, I still don't have a clear idea how this exchange is going to work and what its implications will be. It's my impression that the goal here is a single seller system where no one will have anywhere else to go. And what happens to someone who gets dumped by their employer's insurance and they don't want to give out all their information into the system? It seems to me they will have no options. What if someone like me, who has an individual policy, gets dropped by my insurer? For instance, they go out of business. How will I get out of this data sharing? In USA Today, this has been referenced earlier, Stephen Parente said this would be the largest consolidation of information in the history of the Republic. This scares me. You have said that I will have a choice to enter into this data sharing, but I'm afraid that in the future, this will not be the case. I realize that we need changes and improvements in our healthcare system, but this health insurance exchange bill, with the requirements for exposure of personal information, seems a dangerous and unwise road to travel. I'm not interested in having my private information exposed in such a way and available to untold amounts of people, and in particular several departments of the federal government. Even with all the protections said to be put in motion, I'm not comfortable with that from what I've heard today. A bill like this, with such far-reaching ramifications, deserves our utmost scrutiny and time to decipher whether or not it is really going to help or do more damage than good. I've heard the deadline is to get this passed by March 23rd. It makes no sense to hurry this sweeping bill through based on arbitrary federal deadlines and find out later it's not at all what we really want. There are just too many questions yet to be answered. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Thompson. Are there any questions for Ms. Thompson? All right, thank you. Make sure to sign in there. And Colleen Smith, you are next. And after that, Twyla Brace. Smith, welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much. Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is Colleen Smith, and I'm from Savage. Hi, Senator Hall. I work in a grocery store, have my own business, and I'm very concerned about Senate File 1. I really appreciate the opportunity to share my concerns. With a name like Smith, you can imagine how many mix-ups my husband and I have experienced. Listening to testimony today sounds wonderful. In best case scenarios, though. Let's look at some realities, however. As referenced earlier, I learned that some employees from the DNR were looking at the driver's license data of 5,000 of my fellow Minnesotans. That got me thinking about the health insurance exchange we are discussing today. If looking at driver's license data is possible and puts people at risk for identity fraud, what will happen when all of our data is accessible to no less than 5 federal agencies? The exchange allows the federal government to grab information from state databases and combine it into one location, and then share it with the IRS, the HHS, the DOJ, the Homeland Security Department, and Health and Human Services. Senator Limmer was correct in being concerned about how will we know what happens to this information once it leaves the state of Minnesota. How is this in any way necessary to set up insurance options for us to buy? Why should this purchase be happening through the government at all? Why should state and federal bureaucrats get the data? What if the exchange is my only option for insurance? I can't opt out. What happens if the data is incorrect? Or what if my data is mixed up with another Smith? What happens if the data is hacked? It's your data, too. What if any of you want to run for national office and in an effort to destroy your reputation, someone with access to your private records shares it with your opponent? Or they post it on the web? With so many people having access, how can this be secure? We can't even keep our driving records secure. Clearly, this is not about giving people health care. This is an all-encompassing information grab about every aspect of our lives. I've heard people say that the data is out there. True, it is. But this will be an all-in-one place. Everybody's referenced, or a few people have referenced, the USA Today article. And the Federal Data Services Hub will be collecting information about where you work, your driving record, what you look like, your medical record, including your bad habits, your income, and your criminal record. It might even have what licenses you have, including gun ownership. And it goes on and on. If this legislation was labeled the National Personal Information Consolidation Act, every American would be outraged. But it's happening, and it's under the guise of health care. I ask that Senator Hall not apologize for wanting clarification in advance of what power an unrelated board has regarding reasonable data sharing. As I understand it, even don't want to be in the exchange will have their information available to this federal hub. There's no way to opt out. An unelected board will decide what information is reasonable, and then it's going to be too late. I'm so frightened by this. Please don't pass any part of this health insurance exchange bill. Or if you do, make sure no one gets my data without my written consent. Not the hub, not me. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Ms. Smith. Are there any questions for Ms. Smith?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
I feel compelled to ask a couple questions. Ms. Smith, there's been several of you, the last two or three people, have testified about driver's license data. I can get your driver's license data right now. It's not difficult. Although there's privacy relative to the data, if you go to DMV, they have a detailing of about nine reasons or so, maybe eight reasons, as to how you can get access to data. And anybody who's clever could probably come up with a reason to do so. I get driver's license data frequently relative to legal matters. And all I have to do is to sign an affidavit that I need this information for the purpose of pursuing litigation, and I can get access to the driver's license data. Over the last approximately 10 years, I believe it started with the Bush campaign in 2004, and it was taken to, as has been quite clear from discussion and writing since this past fall's election, taken to a higher level by the Obama campaign. But the Romney campaign did the same thing, where they collect data from all sorts of sources and can go to a particular voter and say, this voter does this, 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 and this, and this ought to be our voter.
I'm sorry, Senator Cohen, I don't want to be rude, but was there a question?
The question is...
Ms. Smith.
Let me make clear. Senator Cohen has the floor. He can speak if he wishes, and it's not the role of the testifier to ask if the senator has a question for you. When he finishes, if he has a question,
pardon,
he'll ask
Senator
it, Ms.
Cohen.
Smith. Thank
Sorry.
You.
No, Mr. Chairman, that's fine. The point of this is that data is available in thousands of different ways in this country, and whether that's a good idea or a bad idea, anybody who's clever, and that's why I cited the presidential campaigns, particularly of George Bush and Barack Obama, took it to a much higher level, where they accumulated all sorts of data on individual citizens available without any legislative need, so or any legislative mandate to do so. So I think some of that's overstated. The particular question is, you've indicated, and I believe witness prior to you indicated as well, that if you were to be, if your health insurance were to be terminated for whatever reason, and you're fearful of participating in this exchange, then I guess you have the choice, then it's your choice then to go uninsured. I haven't heard a suggestion as to what would replace the Affordable Health Care Act in terms of providing insurance to your hypothetical situation where you become uninsured. But if one is paramount to the other, then you'd have the choice to be uninsured.
But then I would
Smith,
be fine.
Could you have a comment you'd like to make in response to Senator
yes,
Cohen?
Yes, thank you, Chairman.
Ms. Smith.
First off, if I would be fined for not having insurance, so I would have a penalty imposed upon me for non-action. And secondly, I don't want people to have to be clever, with all due respect, to try to ascertain my driver's license information. True, you can look at me and see my height and weight, but you don't know whether or not I have DUIs. And if your affidavit is legitimate and you truly want to get information on me, then you may obviously have a good purpose. Yes, there is a lot of data out there, but the data is available and compiled by agencies that do it for a living. They do not do it with the scope and the power of the state and federal agencies. So we are talking about having data compiled on us from everywhere, not just surveys, not just publicly available information. My medical information is not public. It's between me and my doctor, but it will be now uploaded to the federal government, available to be viewed by any number of bureaucrats. Did that answer your question?
Ms. Smith, actually your driver's license record is public. I can go down there without any showing and get your public record and find out if you have a DUI.
Thank you for that clarification, Chairman. I stand corrected.
And Just the point, right now, if you've got medical records that are part of your private insurance company, every bureaucrat that works for that private insurance company has access to those records as well. So the only difference is who are they employed by, as to your other point. But Senator Limmer, you had a follow-up?
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Chair. Ms. Smith, maybe I can paraphrase a little bit. I think you're concerned that if government has information somehow, as attested by even Senator Cohen, that someone's going to get it. Because government is the source of it, of holding it. And they don't really have a good record of keeping it close to the vest. And what is now considered rather a private relationship between you and your doctor, now that government will have its hand in it and it's shared outside of the borders of the state of Minnesota, we will not be able to enforce our laws protecting your privacy because it's outside of our borders. And I think that's what Ms. Smith is concerned about. You know, I've been around here long enough when we were beginning to make sure we protected these records. But the discussion was around other issues. Issues like who in our society has sickle cell anemia? Who in our society has AIDS? And would that information, if it got out in the public, would it be a danger to perhaps the very citizen that that information would be revealed? I think that's the concern, am I right, Ms. Smith, that you're having about who can abuse the information that government now will share amongst itself, among different layers of government, and they don't have a real good record of keeping it private. Is that correct, Ms. Smith?
Ms. Smith?
That is correct. Thank you for clarifying my point.
Thank you.
Senator Ortman had a question.
Senator Letts.
Senator Cohen, to follow up on that specific
question. Yeah, Mr. Chairman, if I can inquire of Senator Limmer, can you specify the instances where the government has not protected data? Because you've suggested in using the analogy to or the comparison to private insurance data, it sounds like they do a very good job of protecting data. So can you specify the instances where the government, state, local, or federal has not protected data?
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
You know, the legislative auditor a few years back, maybe 14, 15 years ago, they had a investigation of why the Department of Public Safety revealed driving records and other more intimate details of private citizens, something to the tune, if I remember right, 50 or 500,000 names and records were revealed. It was by a misuse of a laptop computer that was left in a public setting and someone got a hold of it. This happens all the time. It wouldn't take more than a few clicks on the internet Google search and find out where government has sloppily held records, and whether it was intentional or accidental, the private citizens' records, sometimes the most intimate of records that are entrusted to government, has been revealed. I think there's years and years of exposés on government bureaucracies, agencies, and employees that have misused and mishandled the sanctity of that data privacy.
Senator Letts.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
I can respond to Senator Limmer. You've cited an example of state government, and some inquiring as to where the federal government has done this, because you've cited a state government, and one of the arguments I've heard is everything ought to be done through the state and through state government. I would also wonder, and of course, as people who know me well know, my computer ability is somewhere around the level of a third grader. So I'm not the person to do this, but given the folks who are very clever, what's to keep them from hacking private insurance data? You suggested that there's a sloppiness on the part of government. That sloppiness is equally there on the part of any place in private industry, including the private insurance industry, if somebody's clever enough to get access to that data. So the fear you suggest, which is a legitimate one, and that's the misuse of data, I would suggest that the attempt to suggest the federal government is the only place where there can be some failure to provide proper oversight, given the technology available today, is true anywhere with anything.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe that there is all kinds of data that's in the public sphere, and it's being accumulated by President Obama, by politicians, by Walgreens, by, I mean, all that information is being amassed. There's no question about it. It's a very different thing when you say that government is going to collect that information and not keep it private. And I think it's misleading to suggest that the government will protect our privacy when it collects this information. If you're going to say it's all going to be public, that's a different conversation. But instead, we're hearing reassurances that this information is going to be maintained in a private way. And those reassurances fall flat with me. And I gave some examples, Senator Cohen. And I know that there is private data in the driver's license database that is only supposed to be revealed with a legitimate law enforcement purpose. That database has been breached so many times. And, Senator Limmer, you're right. But you may not realize that the legislative auditor is about to release another report saying it's still happening, it's a huge problem, and the legislature has to deal with it. Because Chapter 13 is not doing enough to hold our government agencies accountable for the data that they have. And in my experience, we've gone through huge contortions to try and make sure that the information is private. For instance, we do audit trails, where the agencies have an audit trail that reports back to them who has accessed the information. But they often don't do anything with the audit trail. So if they have it, but they don't use it to enforce improper access, we're all at risk. And so I say, if we know that it's not going to be kept private, let's just be honest with Minnesotans and say the government's collecting this information on a public basis. It's going to be made available. There are likely to be government breaches of this data, and we all should just acknowledge it. Let's just be honest with Minnesotans. If we're going to say we're going to keep it private, and like the bill says, we're going to maintain the integrity and confidentiality, then we better make sure we're doing it and not say, well, it's being collected somewhere else anyway. That's not good enough.
Senator Laurie, I understand that if the state doesn't take action here, the feds are going to set up an exchange, and any enrollees will operate directly through the feds, and this data hub will accept that data from enrollees anyway. So am I correct in that?
Mr. Chair, you are correct in that. And
Senator Laurie, the natural follow-up point then is that the discussion here about whether or not the federal government can maintain its database properly is one which was really one directed at Congress and the existence of the Federal Affordable Health Care Act. Is that right, Senator Laurie?
That is right.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Well, what about the data sharing agreements that are authorized between the federal and the state government here?
Well, my understanding, and Senator Laurie can correct me, but understanding that the state would be collecting this data because it's choosing to run the exchange and can, in fact, exercise its higher level of protection under Chapter 13 than the federal government may necessarily require as well, and we have more control over it that way. So in a sense, one might conclude that the state will give better protection than perhaps the federal government could give, at least at certain points of entry into the system.
Mr. Chair, with all due respect, I'm wondering if you've heard anything I've said. You're saying that the state is going to provide an extra level of protection, and I'm saying that is not realistic given what we know about the data breaches in the state of Minnesota. It's not realistic.
Well, then I look forward to Senator Ortman's funding bill to improve the technology and data information systems for the
Well, Mr.
The
Chair,
state.
With the new $2 billion in money that the governor wants to raise, I'm sure he's got all kinds of money to spend all
Senator
over.
I think
Senator
we
Lutz.
Better get to work on
Senator
it.
Lutz.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Senator Laurie, while you're at the table, would you mind reminding me, I thought in earlier testimony that you talked about this process, the graph that we looked at, where people choose to move through the exchange. There isn't anything in the bill that says a person can buy health insurance in some other way other than through the exchange. So you have that choice. You don't have to give the data. And you also have indicated you have to give up other things, of course, for the privacy of not. I've worked in the field where we've given Tennyson warnings to person in the private marketplace. I heard a reference to the Tennyson warning on several occasions during the presentation. And the purpose of the Tennyson warning is to articulate what's being discussed here, which is there is risk. Whenever you share information, whether it's with a private, with a person who's in the medical field, and you implement the insurance process for collecting some money on that service that I've provided as a healthcare professional, you're taking risk, because certainly in the clinics in which I have practiced, there are all sorts of people that translate and transfer that information. They all have access to it, and at any point, that person is capable of telling their neighbor or their friend or their community very private information, whether it's HIV or pregnancy or disability or genetic information. So my understanding is this discussion about perfection, about controlling information, is understood in the Tennyson warning, that there isn't such a thing, and that at any time that you give out personal information, you take a risk. And I just want to make sure that I heard that correctly, and I also want to make certain that there's nothing in the bill that prohibits a person from, this is the individual market or small businesses, those people don't have to go to the exchange and buy insurance. Is that correct?
Senator Lori?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, all of that is correct.
Ms. Smith, I think the discussion has moved beyond your particular testimony, so I thank you for appearing before us today.
Didn't want to get up without being excused, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And we'll invite Twyla Brace as our next testifier up, but Senator Cohen, while Ms. Brace is coming up.
Yeah, I don't want to belabor this, but just a quick comment. What we're hearing is concerns on the part of, I guess on one hand, the state government, the state of Minnesota government, and maybe in the exchange between the chairman and Senator Ortman and Senator Limmer, there's the need to provide some additional funding for security relative to the state's responsibility in terms of a database. But what I've heard is a fear on the part of the federal government using some of this healthcare data. And I'll be honest, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I have a strong concern if the federal government knows that I've had heart bypass surgery or some other medical procedure or whatever. The place where there really would be potential for concern, and it's not been expressed, would be the IRS. And I've not heard of any place where the IRS has disclosed significant private financial data on the part of individuals. So I'm not sure why we fear one and not the other. Maybe we fear the IRS, but that would be simply that'd be an unfounded fear. I'm not aware of any disclosure, inappropriate disclosure on the part of the IRS relative to financial data, irrespective of whom the president's been. The one exception to that in my lifetime that I can think of is where President Nixon secured tax data in the compilation of his so-called enemies list 40 years ago. But otherwise, I've not heard of the misuse of IRS data. So, you know, we could just carry this on ad infinitum in terms of any agency, but we need to have, as opposed to an unfounded fear, I'd like to hear something in terms of the actuality where this data has not been properly used.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Goodwin.
I just want to say one quick, I've done this little search here finding out where data leaks have happened, and we've got 40 million credit card accounts at card systems. We got iBill, 17 million records, including names, numbers, and email addresses. Fidelity National Information Services, over 8 million customer records were compromised. Hannaford Brothers supermarket chain, I don't know what they could have got out of that, but Bank of New York and Countrywide Financial Corporation and Check Free Corporation and Heartland Payment Systems and RockU Social Gaming Company and WikiLeaks and Sony PlayStation and on and on. So at any rate, you can see that they're in this day and age with all the information that's out there and that we have to put out there for different things that we do that data leaks are definitely a big problem in corporations and banks and other places that have very important data that could change our lives if somebody took our names.
Question for Senator Lori or Mr. Turpin. Is medical record data shared with the federal hub? I don't see it on the chart that's been provided. It looks like there's other eligibility verification data that's related to that. But medical records, like did Senator Cohen have a heart bypass? Or does someone have HIV or AIDS or is someone pregnant? It doesn't look from here like that's the kind of data that would go into the federal hub. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. And out of respect for the testifiers, I wasn't going to interrupt. I was going to let people finish their testimony, but that is one of the things I was going to come back to. We're not sharing medical information. And you know, if you think about a lot of the breaches that have been discussed are regarding driver's license data. There's specific exemptions for around Chapter 13, and those are the things that have been abused in the state of Minnesota. There aren't going to be those exemptions for really critical health records. We're not going to create those, and we're not creating them here. And the chair's point about a federal exchange versus a state exchange is absolutely critical. If the feds come in and impose the one-size-fits-all federal exchange, the data just goes directly to the feds. And the point that has been made many times is that this is optional. People don't have to go through the exchange to buy their insurance. If you want tax credits and subsidies to help finance your health insurance, then you have to go through the exchange. And that's really the rub. And I understand that people are, you know, particularly lower income, working, hardworking people are probably going to need those tax credits and premium supports in order to buy their insurance. But in order to run a good public system, step through this chart regarding how the Health Information Exchange is going to share this data. If you're just creating a user account, we need to make sure that you are who you say you are, and it's restricted to name, address, and demographic information and language preference, just so that we can communicate with you better. You get a Tennyson warning if you want to go farther and try to determine eligibility within the exchange. In order to do that, we need to get citizenship, lawful presence, and incarceration status. That's to be good public stewards of the public dollar. We need to know these things, and it's not just self-report. Otherwise, we got a really loose enforcement of the supports that we provide for individuals. If you go through that and you actually want to buy insurance on the exchange, you go through another Tennyson warning to say that we're going into another level, and we're going to get so you're there, you're allowed to purchase on the exchange. If you just want to purchase but you don't need access to the subsidies, you're done. You're done giving information. And you can now, with that fairly low level of intrusion on the individual's data, you can go buy a plan on the exchange. If, on the other hand, at this stage of the game, you're able to shop on the exchange, but you want to shop and have access to the subsidies available, well, then we're going to need the income, wage data, and Department of Economic Employment, so that we can confirm what level of subsidies you're eligible for. And these are really critical for proper operations of these core functions of the exchange. And that's really what we're talking about here. So, I mean, I think those are a couple of points. And, I guess I'll let folks get back to the testifiers. I don't know how many more of them there are, but I'll stay up here just in case additional questions come. Right. I know these are sensitive issues.
Thank you. Ms. Brace is the last person who has pre-identified herself to the committee as wishing to testify. So, Ms. Brace, if you'd also try to confine your comments to 3 or 4 minutes, you can see the committee may take some liberty with questions and so on. But go ahead, Ms. Brace. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. I'm going to start with a few clarifications given what I have heard already, and then I have some specific things about the bill that I'd like to share. So some clarifications. One, just to be clear, that in the conversation about, you know, we this and we that and we expect or about data, there's no grand we. There are individuals who want their data shared, and there are individuals who don't want their data shared, and there are individuals who don't care one way or the other. But really, this is an individual item. Whether I want my data shared, the next person wants their data shared, and it's important to understand the individual rights regarding individual data. Another thing has to do with the fact of the data, and there's been conversation here about data breaches. And there's a lot of data breaches, and we know that there really are. But the fact of the matter is, once government takes your data, that's the first breach. If you didn't have a right, if you didn't have control, if you were pushed into a corner in order to get a product, and the government took your data, that's the first breach. That's where the privacy is first breached. Everything after that is security, not privacy. The third thing is the federal exchange. Well, conversation about the federal exchange. Even Politico reports that the feds don't have the money for the federal exchange. They never actually appropriated it for themselves. And now, as Politico says, they have to try and get creative to try and make a federal exchange happen when they don't have any money for it. And you may have noticed that they took off the deadline for determining when states are ready to have with their state exchange. The reason I think they took off the deadline is because if they didn't take off the deadline, they are on a deadline to create the federal exchange, and they don't have any money. So it takes the pressure off of them to create what they don't have any money to create. And the second thing is, even if they would create a federal exchange, Senator Claire Roebling had a very good question several months ago. She said, exactly, how would they impose that on us? What are they going to do to make us share our data? What are they going to do to set up these IT connections? You know, and this is a question. The state still has power. The state doesn't have to share the data. The state doesn't have to connect with the hub. This is up to the state. And then the last clarification is just, what is the exchange? So the exchange is not Travelocity, it's not a marketplace, it's not a one-stop shop. The exchange, according to this bill, it's the marketplace, but the marketplace is a board. And what's the responsibility of the board? The responsibility of the board, in short, is to keep the IT connections going, to keep the data streaming from the state agencies into the federal hub. So this is what the board is doing. It's not like a shopping place. The exchange is actually just a website URL on the central server, which is called the hub. And the hub will have 50 websites, or it might have just 18 websites for the states, one for D.C., and one federal website for all the 30-some states that say no. And then I don't know how the federal government is going to make all of us come to the federal website to purchase health insurance or to use the exchange. So those are the clarifications. Now, specifically to the bill, I want to say about Chapter 13, because there was a lot of conversation about Chapter 13. And I heard it said that it's not exempt from Chapter 13. But I think the language is very nebulous. And if you want to make sure that the people of this state actually believe that when it says that the classification and sharing of data are governed under 62V.6 or 06, whatever that one is, if you really want to make sure, you'll say that this is not exempt from all the provisions and the protections and the penalties of Chapter 13. You'll just make sure that it's in there. You'll make sure it's very clear. Because I don't think it's clear right now. And then I look at the fact that it says that, okay, that 62V dot... 62V.06 says that the sharing, and if you look at 62V.06, it's all of this sharing without really any limits around it. So whatever is reasonably necessary. Well, how will the penalties apply? Who will decide what's reasonably necessary? And when the penalties of Chapter 13 apply, if Chapter 13 really does apply? Reasonably necessary is such a broad loophole, you can take a truck, lots of trucks, and run it through there. The second thing is about the Tennyson warning. A lot of the people who are going to come to the exchange may be like some of the testifiers before me. They won't have had a choice. And so they're just going to, you know, see that little warning and go, well, I don't have any choice. You know, what can I do about it? Or they're not even going to read the warning, perhaps, because it's just so easy. When you're on a website, you just click and click and click, right? And they don't understand how serious this is. I don't know what the Tennyson warning is going to look like. Will it be something that really looks like a warning or not? I have no idea, but I do know that a lot of people will be forced to go onto the exchange because of this sticker shock, and they won't feel like they have a choice. And as much as it is said here that there's a choice to be uninsured, what if they have cancer? That's not really a choice, but now they have to give their data to the hub. They have to give their data to the federal government. They have to open up all their data that they don't even know about in state agencies. Suddenly those agencies' portals are open and the hub can come in and grab the data. So I think the whole thing about state and federal law is very wishy-washy. I think they get to pick and choose. And when I heard, I think it was that gentleman over there, say that if the state law stops the exchange from functioning, that will not be the law that's picked. They will pick the federal law. So that doesn't sound very protective to me, and it doesn't sound like it takes precedence, that Chapter 13 takes precedence. He said the entities involved, right? Well, the biggest entity involved is each of us as individuals whose data is about to be shared, you know, hither and yon, and able to be collected in this one thing called the hub, to be shared as we will not exactly know what will happen. So, and I'm not convinced with the data sharing agreements, that's not law. And that requires people to oversee them. With the fact that 62V.06 is very broad, loophole, that there's really no penalties attached, who knows what can be said in those data sharing agreements and would be considered reasonably necessary. I do have for a page to bring this diagram just to show you your question was about medical data. And The contract with Maximus, the $41.2 million contract with Maximus, who's going to be in charge of keeping these IT connections open 24/7, in the contract it says the data to be shared is going to be private data, confidential data, welfare data, medical data, non-public data, health records, chemical health records, protected health records, electronic health records, federal tax data, a record as defined by the Federal Privacy Act of 1974, and other data. So, you know, I think that when I look at this bill, I don't see protection. I heard a lot of comments today about protection, but when you really look at it, the loopholes are big and the protections are not strong, and all sorts of people who are not us, we the people who have our data in there, are going to have our data taken, and we aren't going to have a choice because some of us aren't going to be able to stay off the exchange, and there won't be a choice. That'll be our only place if we want health insurance, if we want health insurance for our children. We will not be able to stay off the exchange. So, of course, we oppose this bill, and we would certainly ask you to consider the concerns that I have shared. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brace. Are there any questions specifically to any points made by Ms. Brace? All right. Thank you for your testimony. Please be sure to sign in. All right. So at this point, we are on the main bill, and we'll inquire if there. Oh, I'm sorry. Phil Griffin also indicated he wanted to speak. Mr. Griffin, why don't you go ahead and again, I ask you to be brief.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Phil Griffin, and yes, I will try to be extremely brief. I'm appearing today on behalf of my client, Preferred One, and also on the Minnesota Council of Health. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. We appreciate the work that Senator Lurie has done on this bill, and of health plans has supported universal coverage for Minnesotans, and we've also supported in last year's session with the help of legislators state-based health insurance exchange bill. We believe we should focus on three primary principles in doing this. The first, to create an insurance exchange that works for Minnesota. The second, to be mindful of the affordability for all Minnesotans, particularly those who purchase through the exchange. And third, focus on minimum federal standards so that the state has a chance to get the insurance exchange up and running this year. We have a large number of concerns about the bill as it was introduced, and we've been working with Senator Lurie to try to through all those purview of this committee, but they relate things like governance and the financing of this bill. But in particular, the things that have been discussed here today that we want to raise are the rulemaking issue that's been brought forward, and while that's not necessarily the purview of this committee, it does come back to this committee. In fact, we don't think that necessarily exempting this entity from the current challenged in court, and we want to raise that with the committee today. You've also discussed numerously and heard other witnesses and senators talk about this word reasonably data that is going to be collected and used by the exchange, and the data that's reasonably necessary to carry out the functions of the exchange is not what you need. You need the data that is necessary, and we would ask you to consider moving forward with that.
Mr. Chairman, as I said, we look forward to the opportunity to work with Senator Lurie in trying to pass a bill that will work here in Minnesota.
Are ready by October 1st. This is not something that I just want to pass by on this committee. Systems that we have within companies to work with the exchange. If we don't do this in a timely fashion, we cannot turn this thing on a dime. So it's very important for the legislature to move this in a timely fashion. I would like to thank you for this opportunity to testify. Mr. Chairman, I hope this was brief enough, and thank you for the opportunity today, and Senator Lurie, for your testimony. I will sign in if there aren't any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Griffin. Are there any questions for Mr. Griffin? See no such questions. All right. We are on the main bill. Senator Lurie, Mr. Turpin, is there anything you'd like to say in response to Mr. Griffin's comments or any other comments before we
I'm good.
All right. Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chairman, just a few questions before we maybe finish. Was it my understanding that the rules developed under the exchange, perhaps counsel can remind us. I know she answered this question before, but I just want to make sure. The rules that we are creating or giving the authority to make rules to the board, they have the full force of law?
Mr. Chairman, yes, the initial rules.
And then in the event that this would pass, is it we in the legislature that are giving that legal authority to the board for that purpose?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator Lemmer, yes, that's my understanding.
All right. A couple other points, Mr. Chair, is that in the beginning of the bill, I see, and the ghost of Don Betzold is right behind me, and there's that reference to a creation clause, that maybe that's, in other words, it might be called a findings or a purpose statement, but usually we don't put that into Minnesota state statute. And Senator Betzold would, I know he would be leaping to his feet in the Senate, on the Senate floor, if there was a findings or a clause. Is that necessary to have in this bill?
Senator Limmer, which provision are you referring to?
That would be on
Section 2,
Section 2, lines 17 through 33. Help me out. Get me there again.
No.
Page 2.
Section 2 or page 2?
Page 2, lines 17 through 33. Section 4.
Stab. There more duties. Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I think this really is more than just a statement of purpose, and I've listened to that as well. I believe these are, the core functions of the marketplace, and actually provide an avenue for people to challenge if these core functions are being lived up to. In this instance, and I am sensitive to that where we put, kind of platitudes in there, what we're trying to accomplish in the beginning of a bill. I'm usually supportive of stripping those out, but these, I believe, really do tend to delineate, in broad terms, but what we expect of the exchange board. And I think that it actually is of value to keep in the bill in this instance as well. So, that's my assessment of it. If the committee thought otherwise.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Senator Lurie, your point is, you think these are substantive provisions.
I do believe these are substantive provisions rather than just aspirational goals.
Senator Limmer?
Mr. Chair, when we use words such as on line 21, promote innovation and quality, that to me seems like an opinion. On line 24, facilitate and simplify the comparisons and choice and enrollment and purchase of health benefit plans. I think that remains to be seen. When we look on line 28, assist small employers with access to small business health insurance tax credits. Maybe that's a goal, but I'm not sure. If we're getting very close to labeling this bill as having those qualities. And I'm not so sure if that has yet been proven. And I think that's why I think Senator Betzel, I'm not going to speak for Senator Betzel, but it's certainly my reason why I would object to putting these opinionated statements into our law when it hasn't even been passed. And it's going to be in comparison or partnership with a federal government that I'm not quite so sure, and no one yet has convinced me that that will be a Minnesota-friendly relationship. And so I think Senator Betzold is correct to generally strike those types of references in our law. And I don't know what it does to court cases. Or if someone's in opposition to this, I guess I'm in, if I was going to vote against the bill when it finally gets to the Senate floor, I guess I'm voting against the promotion of innovation and quality and value. And I'm against the facilitating and simplifying the purchase of health care. I'm not sure if that can be seen, but someone could accuse me of doing that if I happen to, my limited amount of wisdom, indicate or come to the conclusion that I don't think this is a good thing. So I guess,
Senator Limmer, we will accuse you of that either way, whether it's in the bill or not.
That may be true. So I'm just making a statement of my concern about that. I did have some other concerns on lines 5, or page 5, lines 30 through 31. Just a clarification. Let's see. There's a reference to the board that they will be able to, on line 30, take any other action reasonably required to implement and administrate its responsibilities.
Senator Limmer, I'm just going to remind you that we're dealing only with the data practices and appeals sections of the bill for purpose of jurisdiction, so your question may be more appropriately addressed to a different committee or the floor.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess the question, at least for the purpose of this committee, is does that mean that the board can impose a lawsuit? Would that be considered a reasonable action under any other action reasonably required? Could they administer, be a party to a lawsuit? Could they try to enforce a criminal charge if there was a criminal reference to this? It's a rather broad statement. That's why I'm raising it. And I don't know if I have an answer to it or if anyone else may. What would be
Pontius,
a reasonable?
Can you give us any guidance on this?
Mr. Chairman, I think it's fair to say that it certainly wouldn't have any authority in the criminal area. And I don't see any enforcement power here. They would obviously have be able to defend as a party to a lawsuit.
And one last reference.
Senator Limmer.
Is on page 4, lines 11 through 16, regarding conflicts of interest. I noted we had a brief discussion of who would be members of the board. Would they be practitioners? Would they be bureaucrats? Would they be agency heads? Could they be legislators? And I see that there is a particular class of citizen that would be barred from membership, and that it would be a fear of a conflict of interest. That classification of citizen would be anyone who would be an insurance producer or a health carrier, healthcare provider, and I'm just wondering, why would we bar membership to this board with these people, where everyone else in the country, I guess, can be in it? But why are we singling these people out and barring them? They're the practitioners in the field, or at least in a segment of the field. I would think they could bring a specific experience right on the front line of their business to the board and give them direction and advice rather than be ostracized from that decision-making board. Senator Lurie, do you have a knowledge of why that was suggested?
Senator Lurie.
Senator Latt, Senator Limmer.
Too far into this question because it's outside our jurisdiction, but Senator Lurie.
You know, on the conflict of interest, to your point about making sure that we have expertise, we take that very, very seriously and want all expertise and all perspectives reflected and honored. One of the troubles is we really have to build a board that has the public trust. And if we have members sitting on this board with a current direct financial conflict of interest where somebody's actually paying them, you have to at some point ask who this individual is responsible to. The consumers that are going to be buying, you know, coverage on this market, or the person who's paying their check. And it really cuts at the public trust. And it is an issue that is discussed much and provides a great deal of heartburn to some in the industry. There is also mandatory advisory groups where we include these voices, and certainly, you know, if you can have a great deal of this expertise and direct experience, it just can't be with that direct financial conflict of interest that cuts at the public trust. That is a core function of making sure that this board operates for the benefit of those trying to purchase health care on this exchange.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer, last comment on this topic?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, this kind of reminds me of the guardian ad litem board, where we bar guardian ad litems from being on the very board that governs their actions. And I don't necessarily see the conflict of interest of professionals being on a board to give advice. But in conclusion, we've asked a lot of questions. I'm still not satisfied that I got all the answers, and I understand your position, Senator Lurie. You're kind of on a moving tide a little bit. You don't know what the federal government's really going to do. We've got their promises out there. We have some directives that have been given to the states, and yet at the same time, I know I'm very protective. I've had a long history being very protective of citizens' data rights in the state of Minnesota. I am a little cautious about going forward on this particular bill because there's been a very unique and special relationship with the people of Minnesota and the legislature. They know that we're here to do our very best to protect their data privacy rights. And I'm fearful that this may create a breach that we cannot control. There's other issues that I've brought up that I think show some weakness in what we have before us. I know it's a work in progress, but Mr. Chair, I would move that we table this bill because I just don't think it's ready for action right now. I'd ask for a roll call vote, Mr. Chair.
All right, the motion to table is not debatable. The request for a roll call, there will be a roll call. We'll call the roll.
Senator Dietzick?
No.
Senator Sharon?
No.
Senator Goodwin?
No.
Senator Limmer?
Yes.
Senator Cohen?
No.
Senator Ortman?
Yes.
Senator Hall?
Yes.
Senator DeLatz?
No. There being three yes votes and five no votes, the motion did not prevail. Senator Sharon?
May I move Senate File 1?
Senator Sharon moves adoption of Senate File 1. And where does it go to next, Senator Lurie?
It's amended, referred to Commerce.
Okay. Senator Sharon moves that Senate File number 1 be adopted as amended and be re-referred to the Senate Commerce Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. That concludes our agenda for today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.